Political infighting continues over the future of JEA. Duval gets ready to appoint a new schools superintendent, and the city pays tribute to a fallen JSO officer. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we're always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, we'll spend most of the hour with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, how the magic of virtual reality is bringing the outside world inside to local kids who are stuck in a hospital. It's a pretty cool story. We'll tell you about that, too. All of that and more ahead this morning, but first, it's Friday and time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome David Bauerlein, reporter for the Florida Times Union. Hey, good to see you.
Good morning, Melissa.
Our own regular contributor, Fred Matthews, is here. Hey, Fred.
Good morning, Melissa.
A.G. Gankarski with Florida Politics.
And a regular contributor.
That's right. Another regular contributor. And our new regular contributor, John McGowan, columnist with the Beaches Leader. Hey, John.
Good morning.
Good to have all of you here, guys, and lots to talk about this week. Everything from big federal dollars headed toward the St. John's River Ferry, tributes to a fallen JSO officer this week, and we'll talk about that shortlist for the new Duval County School Superintendent, all of that ahead. But our top story this morning, more drama yet again over the future of Jacksonville's public utility, JEA. This week, JEA board member Fred Newbill accused City Council President Anna Broche of, in his words, trying to play politics with JEA over its new leadership. Broche had asked the JEA board a series of questions about the process the board used to select one of their own, former board member Aaron Zahn, as the utility's interim CEO. Newbill calls that part of an attempt to challenge Mayor Lenny Curry in the next election, which Broche has said she's considering. But for her part, the city council president says she's simply trying to do her job as a council leader, since the hiring of Aaron Zahn was controversial and, in her words, did not seem to go through the normal vetting process. She said Zahn should have undergone the same vetting and background checks that other JEA employees have to go through before they're hired. So we begin the hour with a closer look at the latest franchise on this program. Yes, it's a very successful and long-running franchise. 50 Shades of JEA.
Is Christian Grey in this?
Nope. No.
To quote another of my favorite franchises, just when we thought we were out, they're pulling us back in. Give us a call at 549-2937 as we discuss this. Let's begin with you, John McGowan. I'm sorry to tell you, this is our lead topic. As you tweeted yesterday, you would prefer to move on from this, but here we are again. And you said you'd even pay cash money not to talk about JEA. So where's our fistful of 50s?
I think there's a good fundraising drive to be had if we can just say, hey, look, if you call and donate today, we will stop talking about JEA on the show.
McGowan on the rise.
I can form a pack. At any conversation on JEA at this point is going to be political. I mean, the issue is pretty much done, has been killed within the city council by the mayor. So there's no real policy discussion. And it's a political discussion. I mean, that's not an abnormal accusation to make or comment to make in the middle of politics. I mean, this is a political discussion. So I really think going forward, any conversations we have on this, they're going to be a political conversation because the issue has pretty much been discussed. It's been done. The mayor has said he's not pushing for the sale of JEA. The council president doesn't support it. It just keeps coming back up, and it keeps coming back up for obvious reasons. There's an election coming up, and as far as specifically bringing up and questioning the process that Zahn went through, I think it's a legitimate question. I think it's a good discussion to have.
Anna Broche is saying she's trying to hold this new CEO, this interim CEO, to the same vetting process she says all employees should have gone through. And she's saying she's doing this at the request of her constituents who are upset about what they saw as a less than transparent process. David Bauerlein.
Well, first, picking up what John said, I mean, it is going to be a political issue from the standpoint that we've gone through this months-long debate. At this point, the issue is, quote, dead. But there's going to be an election coming up, and I expect that journalists members of the public are going to ask every candidate who's running next year, what's your position on JEA? It's the same way that we went through this big debate about the human rights ordinance. It ended without being passed, but that didn't mean the issue went away politically. And part of the problem this time around was nobody had a political mandate to do anything on JEA. Nobody ran on it, with the exception of Matt Schellenberg. So, like it or not, John, I think there's going to be a lot more questions, a lot more discussion about JEA as we get closer to the election. Now, on the issue of
Anna Bruchet, Rocky franchise had 8 or 9 movies.
Amen.
Yes.
Sorry. Just had to get that in there.
Many, many sequels. But on the issue of the issue on Aaron Zahn's hiring, I mean, the perspective new bill says is there's this political proxy war going on, and JEA is being used at kind of between the mayor and Anna Bruchet over the future of JEA. Curry appoints the board. Anna Bruchet is criticizing the decisions of that board. But when you step back, there are some legitimate questions, I think, that she brings up. Let's find out what the answers are.
Fred Matthews.
And then we can talk about it.
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, it's going to be the number one question for candidates running for citywide offices between mayor and a few of the council candidates. But let's face it. I mean, the ultimate conspiracy theory is who started it. Who is at the root of it?
We still
well, Tom was walking off the board, and you know, but who, he floated the idea, but that was what, a year and a half ago? How long ago was that?
Six months.
Okay, but he floated it. But these
it feels
guys,
like a year and a half.
Yeah, it feels like longer. And these guys, the board stood by while this bomb exploded. The poor CEO had to go out in front of it and try to work it through. It got all the way into the council and seeped all around and got the unions upset. And we still don't know who exactly pushed this thing. And then after all that's done, the CEO resigns unexpectedly. Unless AG knows something. He resigned unexpectedly. And we have this, who is Zahn? What? He's CEO. What is he qualified for? And the ultimate question comes in. And now finally the board steps in and says, well, we know what we're doing, and it's just politics. It shouldn't be in our business. Okay.
A.G. Right. Yankarski.
Yeah. I was at the meeting yesterday, the council committee meeting, along with Dave over here. Bruchet enumerated the questions. Documentation of the selection process. How they do employee screening. How they did employee screening on Zahn. Documentation of meetings between Zahn and board members after he left the board and before he became CEO. Awareness of Zahn's intention to leave the board to become CEO. A background check. References. The reason Bruchet is asking these questions, which she has yet to get answers to, is because there is no demonstrated due diligence. I mean, there have been votes for the Pope that have had more transparency than that process at JEA.
And we didn't even get the white smoke.
Yeah, we did not. And that's really the issue here is, you know, why can't they answer those questions? So, I mean, to call this a political discussion, yeah, that's part of it. Does Bruchet want to be mayor? Maybe. I mean, Fred Newbill, he knows politics as well as anybody in the city. I mean, he's the dude who came out with Ken Atkins to do an anti-HRO press conference. Then when he wanted on JEA board, he told Tommy Azuri he saw the light on HRO. We have political operators all throughout this thing, and you know, that's all this traction from the questions Bruchet is asking and the community is asking, which have yet to be answered.
And then they voted to pay the what we'll call the assistant director, CEO, the COO of JEA. How much? I think it's up to $400,000 for second chair.
Don't forget the bonuses.
Oh yes, don't forget the bonuses. And a car and all of that. $400,000 to the second chair. She'll be making more than the CEO, but we didn't want her to get the job.
Your comments are so incendiary. You're getting calls, Fred, right here in the studio. All right, let's go to some calls from the public. It's 549-2937 to join the Friday Media Roundtable. David is in Mandarin. Hi, David. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I'd like to make a couple of comments. One is, back years ago, JEA joined a group of other Florida cities that owned utilities, and it was a TEA group in which JEA went to the Florida Supreme Court. And I'm not an attorney, but it sort of, in my opinion, affirmed that the city utility served a public purpose and was under the city in order to join this. And the second thing is, if the CEO thinks he's independent, telling to support his own debt without the full faith and confidence of the city. Until he can do that, we are the owners. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Let me ask you as a follow-up to his comments, what about this notion of a straw ballot referendum on the November ballot that would test the voters' mood on a JEA sale, a non-binding referendum? John McGowan, it would add a whole other page to the ballot, which is probably the last thing the supervisor of elections wants. But that's another idea that's been floated so that the public could theoretically have more of a say on this.
Well, it's a non-binding thing. It's political theater to do it. You can discover the same information by running a poll. A straw ballot, not this year. I mean, let's just face it. We've got 13 constitutional amendments. We've got all these things that are going to be on the ballot. It's already going to overflow. They're trying to keep it to a single page. This may run it to a second page. And I don't think you're going to learn anything new that you can't learn from a poll, like a regular poll. But doing a straw ballot, it becomes a theater and becomes making people feel like they're involved. And it
well,
but
I'm sorry you do poo-poo the democratic process there.
But it's non-binding. But it doesn't mean anything. Well, a straw poll doesn't mean anything.
And whose poll are we gonna
believe?
That's like
the Chamber of Commerce's hobnob over here or something like that. Straw polls don't mean anything. It's non-binding. It doesn't do anything. If we were putting on the ballot whether it could actually take place and that was a binding resolution, that's a conversation to be had. But this is
as bad as when Mike Hogan showed up at that JEA meeting yesterday and said, well, the ballot may be too long. We may have to spend another $100,000 printing the ballots. I mean, come on. If you're going to have elections, the council passed the resolution to get the straw ballot. Those council members duly elected. The people should be able to have the say, even though nothing is happening right now. Who's to say what's going to happen in 6 months? Who's to say what's going to happen after May 2019?
But it's not binding. It doesn't mean anything.
None of it is binding, really. What's binding is what Ed Burr and Peter Rummel and Pettway and those people want. But, you know, let's just leave that aside.
Yeah, we're not voting on... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'd say if I could just jump in, just for clarification, my understanding is this straw ballot is just to ask people whether they think the voters should have the final say on whether JEA is sold. So it's not a ballot saying, do you support or oppose the selling of JEA? And so, yeah, that's what the straw ballot's about. And, you know, if you have a private corporation and it's sold to somebody, the last decision that you check off is the shareholders. Do you support the sale?
You get that little letter in the mail and you check yes or no.
The same thing here, which is, do you think that city council should make the final decision, or do you think the final ultimate decision should be made by the residents and voters of Duval County?
But well,
why not? Yeah, if you don't do it in November, at what point do you do that kind of a straw ballot?
But what do you gain by doing that? Because it's non-binding, and you're not asking them what their thoughts are. You're asking them what their thoughts on whether they should be able to express their thoughts. And that's really what it is. And it's even non-binding at that. The council could still say, because by the time this actually becomes an issue, it'll be different council leadership. It'll be a different council. And they could then say, thanks, guys. Thanks for the input, but we're still going to do it ourselves. Or it could never come up again. I mean, it's a poll on – I mean, it's a straw ballot that's non-binding on whether they think they should be able to have another –
opposed to direct democracy, John.
The Iowa straw poll in presidential cycles?
That's a
totally separate question.
That's a totally different question. But they do that every
4 years.
But it's still non-binding.
But
people love the theater of it.
People love doing it.
The theater of it. But we don't do that here. We don't do straw polls on the ballot traditionally here in Jacksonville.
Maybe we will now, though. It seems as though the city council is trying to do something to at least give the appearance that they care about what the public's feelings are on this.
Well, I think the idea is that they're going to have a vote by the city council sometime next month to change the charter that would basically say, henceforth, any sale of JEA must be approved by the voters. And the idea is by doing this straw ballot, John, and you can agree or disagree with whether it's needed, which is basically saying that if a future council wants to come back and change that charter back again, the people would say, well, hey, you know, the voters spoke on this. You can change it at your own peril.
Let's go to Andy.
It's a backstop.
Let's go to Andy at the beaches. Andy, you're on the air.
I have a very short comment. I'm against selling the JEA. Therefore, I'm against the straw poll because I know that right now 90% of the people in Jacksonville are against it. But if you spend enough money, you can still win the poll.
They're that former radio host and lawmaker Andy Johnson calling in. Thanks for that comment, Andy. Okay, and we could keep talking about this for a while, but in the interest of moving on from this long-running franchise, 50 Shades of JDA, we're going to also talk about some other news and notes.
The appropriate themes of sadomasochism here.
Now, as the JEA drama continues with allegations that its leadership hiring process was less than transparent, the city is also dealing with allegations that it is less than transparent when it comes to the sharing of public records. The aforementioned City Council President Anna Brochet held a task force on open government this week, just as Mayor Curry's office and other City Hall officials are being accused on multiple fronts, including from a reporter at Reuters, of contravening the letter and spirit of open government by slow-walking public records requests, vetting seemingly problematic applications with affected officials before they fulfill the requests, claiming exemptions from disclosure, not providing complete email and text records for public officials, and so on. Mayor Curry defended the city's handling of public records requests. AG Gankarski, you've tried to make requests. Reporters here have tried to make requests. Your thoughts?
The task force is something Brochet set up a few months ago, sort of to get an idea of transparency and open government. And there was a panel last week involving your news director, Dave's editor of Times Union, and me. And we were discussing difficulties getting requests, difficulties getting information, the inaccessibility of certain emails, and so on. Reuters was requesting material on cybersecurity, which the city kept imposing exemptions, saying that they didn't have to disclose that information. So all this kind of came to a head in the last week or so. Curry defended the administration's position, saying he's proud of the record and transparency. Insert laugh track from some people here. Marsha Oliver from the administration, Craig Fieser, who handles records disclosure, he came to the task force, and both of them said that we substantially fulfilled a request. This seems to be an issue that interests media more than interests actual people. So this is really something that I'm not seeing the popular groundswell behind it in the way that you might see behind, say, the royal wedding or something. But this is an issue of media interest, and as newsrooms get smaller, as resource disparities get more broad, I mean, these issues of sunshine, they loom. City government's probably not going to do anything to strengthen its local sunshine protections, because once a politician's in office, they want to do as much out of the sunshine as possible in terms of conversations and so on. I've heard this from multiple council people, so it's going to be business as usual.
Speaking of city council, it appears as though City Councilman John Crescenbeny is calling into the show. Councilman, is that you on the radio?
Hello?
Councilman Crescenbeny?
Yes, good morning.
Hi, thanks for calling in. Good morning. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Well, I wanted to follow up on the conversation about the straw ballot. I've heard someone, I'm not sure who it was, talking about political theater. This is far from anything other than political theater, and they probably should brush up on their local inner workings of city government. If the council had the ability to put something before the people that was binding, I would have done that. I sponsored the bill. That's impossible. It was a case that came out of the city of Jacksonville, in fact. It was Bell versus, I'm sorry, Holzendorf versus Bell. That went to the first DCA, and there was some interesting language that came out of that court case that said people, citizens cannot, through referendum, grant themselves referendum power. So that takes any binding opportunity completely off the table. So the referendum or the straw ballot, and by the way, there's been several straw ballots in recent years on Duval County ballots. But the straw ballot question is a complement to another piece of legislation that Mr. Bauerlein referred to, which is a charter change which the council can enact that would require the measure to go to the public for a vote if at some point in the future the JEA decided to sell and the council decided to sell. The next step would be voter approval. So the purpose of the straw ballot, a straw ballot is essentially a poll. It's a non-binding poll, but it may not be political, legally binding, but it is politically binding, and hopefully that will help drive the second piece of the legislation, which is the charter change. It will certainly give it some oomph, if you will, that the council would support that, and then that once that gets locked down, that would be, you know, a more difficult to change at some date in the future by a successive council. So I just want to make sure those facts are out there.
And the city charter, as I understand it, currently allows the JEA board to unilaterally sell up to 10% of its assets without council approval. You on the city council have the sole authority to decide whether to sell off the whole utility. Amending the charter would require a supermajority of council support. So it sounds as though you just see the straw ballot as the first step in your ultimate goal. It sounds like, councilman, which would be to amend the city charter so that the city would not go through this type of process over again. Is that right? Is that fair to say?
Well, you're close. The charter says that if 10% or more of JEA is sold, it would require council approval. But I've got a couple of legal opinions in my pocket that define what that 10% is. So the ability to play any games with that, you know, sell 9% 10 different times or something, that's not going to work. And so what the charter amendment will do will hopefully help lock down and preserve an opportunity for citizens that someday in the future the council were to decide or approve the JEA sale of more than 10%.
And let me ask you as a follow-up, council leadership is changing over in a month or so, what are your thoughts about the future of this discussion when there's a new leadership slate on the city council?
What discussion? About the straw ballot measure?
Or just this in general?
I have every reason to believe that this conversation, although there's a lot of attempts to make it go away today, it will be front and center 12 or 13 months from now. I suspect by July 1st or August 1st of 2019, this will be on the front burner, and it'll somehow have magically gotten resurrected for discussion, and you know, everybody will be sitting in these seats in government for four more years, and they'll feel comfortable about talking about it then. Preceding an election, it's a different conversation.
Okay, and so we really appreciate you calling in to share your thoughts impromptu this way. Why don't you come back on the show and be an in-studio guest in a few weeks?
I'd love to do that. Call me up. I'll be there anytime because, you know, this whole notion about this straw ballot thing, adding a page to the ballot is ridiculous, too, and I'd like to defend that false allegation.
All righty.
Well.
That's City Councilman John Crescenbeny calling in this morning. Thank you for that. Fred Matthews.
Well, there's your 50 shades. I mean, that we all watched as the councilman have crafted the straw ballot issue, the balloting issue, and of course there's a resolution in it, as we've already spoken about, concerning putting this before the voters for a charter change. This is part of the scheme that's been crafted in council that is leading up to, of course, the committee that we have. And I think, you know, we just heard from a political pragmatist. This is going to come back next year. It has to slide down now because we're leading up to council elections and the mayoral election. So it's going to slide down. Everybody understands that. The key now that everybody has to watch is what we just got this week. Is anybody from the JEA board going to speak? Now, this is the first time we've heard from Pastor Newbill there. About anything concerning this issue. And, you know, we barely heard from the chairman of the board on this issue or anything else. So the council has to be involved. And I think citizens who are watching this are going to continue to watch this closely to see who is going to put their head above the surf. Who's going to fund the set of spots to say we need to sell JEA? That's still out there. Somebody's got to fund it. Somebody's PAC has got to fund this to sell the voters on it. And that's what we're watching. Now, we know the money is already ready to go, but it's a question of who's PAC, what PAC is going to do it. That will begin to be the tail of the tape.
I'll take a swing at it.
All right.
since I seem to be the voice of the opposition here, I don't think anything that Councilman Crescenbeny said contradicted my, you know, the premise of what I was saying. It's non-binding. It is just a poll that is on the ballot. It gives them a political backdrop to then push a charter amendment. But it's still non-binding.
All right, guys.
Yeah.
And I get your point there. And so we will reach out to the councilman And by the way, I get asked about this a lot. This is an open invitation to any city official who wants to appear on this program. Sometimes people say, I heard so-and-so on, why can't I be on that show? You are welcome anytime, ladies and gentlemen. Speaking of city officials, it's down to a very short list in the search for a new Duval County school superintendent. Finalists Michael Dunsmore, Diana Green, and Eric Pruitt made the cut. Dunsmore is from Wayne County, North Carolina Public Schools. Diana Green is the superintendent in Manatee County here in Florida. Eric Pruitt is the Houston Independent School District superintendent. And so focus groups made up of educators, parents, students, and community leaders all interviewed the semifinalists in open meetings over the weekend, and the Duval Schools has been streaming a lot of this live on its website. Your thoughts about this process, David Bauerlein?
Well, the process has been great. I mean, it's been open. They've sought to get feedback from the community. They've brought people in, and basically, if you want to be in superintendent in Florida, you should be able to talk to people in a public session when you're going for the job because of the Florida Sunshine Law. So it's been a great process. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they've been very open about it. People that have wanted to follow it closely have been able to.
I think we're headed in the next decade or so to serious proposals for an elected superintendent. You know, we've had so much turnover over the years and over the decades. Every couple of years is somebody new. These three people are all from other places. And yeah, the process has been open, but it's being chosen by a school board with a name ID of about 10% relatively. These are not really known people who are choosing this in terms of the grand political scheme. Whoever comes in, you have to figure you're going to have 3 years based on the VD model. They'll have buy-in for a while.
That's actually a national model. Superintendents nationally rarely last more than 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, and it raises questions because no matter where you're at in the country, you see a decline in basic skills, a decline in educational quality. And nationally, we see a decline in terms of STEM skills compared to not just the first world, but the second world. If we didn't have so much transition and career hopping, maybe it'd be a little different. If we had sufficient resources, maybe it'd be a little different. If we had family structures that didn't break down, maybe it'd be a little different. But, you know, whoever it is, we're going to see for a couple of years and they'll move on to somewhere else.
And they're expected to name this person, by the way, late this afternoon. Sam at the Beaches has been holding for some time and wants to talk about this story. Sam, good morning. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call. I live out in the Beaches area in school board district number 2. And in fact, I'm on the ballot this fall for the Duval County Public School Board. But I applaud the school board for being very transparent in this process, because they've been very open. I think they've had some good candidates, and I'm sure that they will make the best decision come 4 o'clock this afternoon. But I hope they will choose a person who can hit the ground running, who can address the budgetary shortfalls, and focus on retaining good teachers and principals. I do have a question about the value-added model, the VAM, that is used to evaluate teachers in their placement. So if someone could speak to that, I would appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for the call.
Well, I'm not an expert in this, but basically there's a lot of controversy over it. It's basically something I think the state has come up with to basically score or evaluate teachers. There's some controversy in terms of how that is something that comes into play when the school board is deciding what teachers to reassign where.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's always controversial when you go in and try and use some scorecard to do something to evaluate teachers when that's a very subjective type of job.
Yeah, I mean we're in a sphere now in which the public school system is in direct competition to the private system, and we have a legislature that is in tune with that and is doing all they can to funnel money to charter systems and of course more and more independence to charter systems, which is a direct slap at the public school system. So whatever superintendent we come in is part of what Vini discussed as he was walking out the door. Every superintendent is going to be facing that issue. And of course, you know, one of the things that's been touted for one of the candidates is at least that candidate is from Florida and recognizes the daunting task ahead of her in this case, if she were selected for it, where the other candidates don't have that, don't necessarily have that that feel because they're not superintendents. But I mean, that's going to continue to be an issue for whoever takes the job. It doesn't, and I think. You know, whether you're here or in Chicago, which a number of these candidates do have some experience in, the problem is going to be the same. If they're appointed by the mayor, they're only as good as the mayor, as long as the mayor is going to be there.
And by the way, when getting back to your point about elected versus appointed superintendents, as you were discussing that, I looked this up. 99% of school districts nationwide appoint their superintendents, which is what we're going to see happen probably today here in Duval County. However, in Florida, most superintendents are now elected, 41 of 67. That's according to the Florida Department of Education. This debate is raging right now in Martin County, or it was raging last year, I should say, in Martin County, Florida. This is a discussion that we're seeing increasingly around Florida.
Yeah, I think you're going to see more of it, too, because there's a gap between what a school board's priority is and what business leaders' priorities are. I mean, we saw that during the Vitti era, where the business community was Vitti's staunchest defenders, even as the school board didn't seem to have his back in a lot of cases, especially with the reforms he's trying to push through. So, you know, when you look at where the money's going to go, when you look at where political momentum's going to go, where things can be moved, school boards seem like a logical place.
Well, in order to do that, however, you'll still have to get rid of the elected school board because, of course, a great deal of the tax dollars that that fund it, the property tax dollars, as we know, goes to fund education locally. And you'll have to get rid of the school board if you're going to get rid of the appointment of a superintendent. And that's a charter change and political thing.
That's not necessarily true. I mean, I think every county in Florida still has a school board, but then they also elect the superintendent. Nassau County is that way.
The majority of Florida counties do.
I mean, the ones that do that,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't think any school boards have been dissolved. I think they just elect the superintendent. But I disagree with AG on this. Of course, that's my role today. I don't think electing a superintendent
gets you the best. It'd be boring if everybody on this panel agreed.
If you elect a superintendent, you're going to get the best name ID person. And people don't even pay attention to the school board races as it is. It's considered an entry-level race. People don't. There's a small group of people that pay attention to it, but you know that poll recently that said only 7% of the people in Duval County could name a member of the school board. If you turn that into a superintendent race, what it's going to be is it's just going to be the next stop for the tax collector or the supervisor of elections to go after they're termed out.
But you don't want Mike Hogan to have another job? Come on, man.
It used to be the entry level used to be the Soil and Water Commission race. Remember that one?
It's still there.
Who can deny the magic of the Soil and Water Conservation Board races?
Sounds like you ought to run, Fred.
All right. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. The number to join us, 549-2937. Also this week, hundreds line local streets Thursday as a police motorcade escorted the body of Jacksonville Sheriff's Officer Lance Whitaker, killed in the line of duty in a traffic crash. They took Whitaker's body to a Riverside funeral home. He was 48 and will receive full honors from the JSO Honor Guard at his funeral. The 17-year veteran of the sheriff's office crashed in rainy conditions early Tuesday morning on I-295 while he was responding to another wreck. Sad to see that, a tragedy for his family, and a larger issue for me, it pointed out that our roads aren't really safe out there and that police can endanger their lives just responding to a traffic crash.
Yeah, actually, being a police officer, it can be a very hazardous job, and I think most of us think of it in the sense of a police officer confronting somebody who's got a gun in that kind of a situation.
Right.
But really, one of the most dangerous parts about being a police officer is the time they spent behind vehicles in pretty under duress, in conditions which, as you point out, Melissa, sometimes are not safe even under normal conditions. So that's a real part of the job that's maybe overlooked, but it's definitely a dangerous part of the job.
Yeah.
I wrote a column in February about the police and the risks and what happens. And I tell you, I think one of the things we always talk in abstracts, we talk about the police, we talk about in national debates, but this is a human being, and he had friends and he had a family. And we often forget about that. We talk about the police officer and the risks they have, but we don't personalize it. We tend to not even want to talk to the police officers, and it becomes this battle over police brutality or Blue Lives Matter and all these things. And one of the best relationships I have and the relationships I cherish the most are with the Jacks Beach Police Department and the officers out there. I mean, I live in Jacks Beach. Every night I go for a walk. Every night I make a point to stop and talk to them, ask them how their family is, ask them about, hear them and listen, because they're human beings, and we just don't do that anymore. We've built this wall and this barrier between the public and the police department, and doesn't need to be there. And that burden's not on the police department to bring that down. It's on all of us. When we see a police officer, it's not just go up and say, thank you for your service and thank you for being there, but get to know them as a person and genuinely learn who these people are. This officer started in Atlantic Beach. He served for 2.5 years in Atlantic, or 3.5 years in Atlantic Beach before he went to JSO. He was one of our beach officers. And, it's a small town out there, but we can't just talk in abstracts. We've got to realize that this officer was a person, and the JSO feels that, and officers around the country feel that, because they're so isolated. That's why this hurts so much, and they're so isolated that's why they feel it as a whole.
I don't think that police brutality or walking while black or mass incarceration are abstracts to the people who experience them. I get what you're saying, John. But, what we see in situations like this when we, look at an officer death is we see the push to sort of push the other issues to the side. We have the biggest prison industry in the world. We don't lead in anything else, but we lead in people in prison. Why is that? When we look at the way laws are enforced, they're different based on what part of town you are, what demographic background you have, or whatever. I mean, these are realities. So, to say that they are subsidiary issues, I think is not the case at all. They're primary issues to a lot of people.
I don't think that's the case today. I don't think that's the issue with what this is. This is about an officer who lost his life. And the only point is this is a human being, and we need to remember that, and we need to just remember there was more than just the badge. And the other issues are still valid issues, and they should be debated, but
you just pushed them to the side.
I'm going to push them to the side today. Yeah, I am, because we had an officer die this week, and I don't think that we need to take his death as an excuse to debate other issues. I think we should just understand that the lesson is we lost a life.
What about the fact that as we see protests all over the country, particularly when African Americans, unarmed ones, are shot and killed in incidents with police, at the same time, you did see hundreds of local people line the streets Thursday to honor this police motorcade. I think we can have both of these discussions at the same time, honestly.
We theoretically can, but practically we don't. I mean,
we can on this program. How about that?
I mean, really, really, with this situation, with this officer's death, I mean, it is a tragic situation. The guy died late one night, going to a car wreck. He had a long, distinguished career in the police force, and so on. But let's not get it twisted. There are some serious institutional issues with law enforcement that shouldn't be pushed aside any day.
And we'll continue to vet those through, as we do really all the time on this show. But I really appreciate you guys making those, both of your points. I also want to make note quickly that the St. John's River Ferry got some good news this week. Beloved out at the beaches, the ferry is getting more than $3 million worth of improvements thanks to a federal grant. It will be used for upgrades and maintenance to the ferry slips, the vessel, and the ferry terminal. At the same time, Jacksonville is looking to possibly buy back property out in Mayport Village to spur economic development right where the ferry docks.
I'm going to have to ride the ferry one day.
You got to do it, Fred. It's fun.
Through your soil and water run.
It's good news for the beaches communities.
It is. That the ferry is definitely one of those things that everybody at the beach has this abnormal attachment to. They really love it at the beach. But I think, honestly, that's great. But the more important thing is going to be the Jacksport land swap, because that has really brought down Mayport, and it was well intentioned. They were going to put they were going to move the cruise terminal down there, which is supposed to revitalize the area. It fell apart. Then with the restrictions, this has been a Bill Guilford push for years to get this taken care of, because the way it was managed under Jaxport, not a knock on Jaxport, but the way the contract was originally when they did the land use, nothing really could go there. And it was so overvalued, and they couldn't, no developer would build in there. And we came into these roadblocks where they wanted to build anything there and nothing could be built. So it's just sat empty and empty and empty. Moving it back to the city of Jacksonville will open up that development and allow that area to thrive again.
Right. It's 6 acres or so along Ocean Street and the river. David Bauerlein, the port has voted to sell it back to the city for $1.
Right. And just on the ferry, remember, there was a time when that ferry was on its way out.
Right.
I mean, it really took a great community groundswell support, some people really working hard to keep that ferry. And it's, Fred, you need to take a ride.
You
do,
Fred.
It's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
And at these prices, I am going to take a ride.
And to John's point, I mean, that area there where Mayport is, it's just sat idle. It's an eyesore. You look at something like when you go to St. Mary's to take the ferry to go to Cumberland Island. It's such a nice waterfront. There's restaurants. There's parks. You go, why can't that be possible? Now, to the point of Jaxport, although they did try, I think, a year ago or 2 years ago to put it up for market, and nobody responded. So there's an issue there in terms of what exactly does a private market going to do there. Maybe the changes with the city having ownership, but there may need to be some incentives. There's some work going on there, but it'd be great if it happens.
All right. Finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Now, only in Florida does a man get caught fleeing police, speaking of the police, because his pants fell down. Yes, the Daytona Beach. The Daytona Beach News Journal reports 24-year-old Tobias Smith crashed into a power pole, a fence, and a barbershop as he sped away from police after a traffic stop. No one was injured, but he caused thousands of dollars in damage. He ran from police, but was quickly captured when his pants fell down around his ankles.
Hopefully he was wearing a thong.
Okay, and finally, only in Florida does the half-sister of royal bride Meghan Markle have her very own wedding party. Yes, have you guys heard about the royal wedding tomorrow? I know all of you are going to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning
what
to watch it.
I'm already dressed like Meghan Markle.
What wedding?
The controversial,
I didn't get an invitation.
The controversial half-sister of Meghan Markle is holding a formal wedding party at her home in Florida this weekend. Yes, Samantha Markle has been in the spotlight in the run-up to the big day, even vowing to write a tell-all book about her relationship with Meghan after she was not invited to the real wedding in Windsor.
What wedding?
But it emerged today that Samantha is going to host a wedding party at her home down in Silver Springs, Florida.
Of course, Silver Springs, Windsor, Florida.
Of course she's from Florida. Guests are being told to come in formal attire.
What wedding?
The royal wedding, Fred. Come on! Now, you can tune in to PBS beginning at 4 o'clock tomorrow morning.
I'll still be drunk.
We will have live extended coverage along with the BBC of the big day as, by the way, Northwestern University graduate Meghan Markle, that's my alma mater, weds Prince Harry. I know you guys want to come over for hot tea and scones.
Morrissey sang it best, the queen is dead.
That's cold. That's just cold. But this roundtable is always hot on Fridays. A.G. Gankarski, John McGowan, David Bauerlein, and Fred Matthews. Guys, it's always great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Royal Britannia.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment. Keep listening.
Hospice and palliative care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours, available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
Spar Council presents the 2018 Historic Springfield Tour of Homes Saturday and Sunday, May 19th and 20th. Tour includes 8 unique homes, both historic and modern, within walking or biking distance in Jacksonville's oldest neighborhood. More at springfieldtour.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. It's the number one killer of teens. One text or call can wreck it all. Arrive alive. Let's end distracted driving. More from board-certified civil trial lawyer Wayne Hogan at waynehogan.law.
Moving the U.S. embassy comes at a price. More than 50 Palestinians are shot dead. America says Israel has every right to defend itself.
No country in this chamber would act with more restraint than Israel has.
Also, Iran looks to Europe as Europe looks away from Washington. The global edition of the Friday News Roundup next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Tom Wolfe and listen back to our 1987 interview. He died Monday at the age of 88. Also, an interview with writer Edward St. Aubin, his semi-autobiographical Patrick Melrose novels about growing up in a monstrous upper-class British family have been adapted into a Showtime series. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
The WJCT HD4 pop-up jazz station is now on the air. The Jacksonville Jazz Festival is almost here, so we're playing jazz 24 hours a day on 89.9 HD4 until the Jazz Fest ends. Enjoy the jazz on 89.9 HD4.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it is a cool new virtual reality project that lets kids who are cooped up in a hospital room experience the wonders of the outside world. And this is coming to Jacksonville. Now, next week, the Timaquan Parks Foundation is teaming up with a company called VR Dreams to bring the experience of the park through virtual reality to hospital-bound children who aren't able to get out and explore the wonders of the great outdoors. This is such a great idea. Here with more, we welcome Foundation Executive Director Mark Middlebrook. Good morning.
Morning.
Good to see you. And joining us on the phone, VR Dreams Executive Director Peter Von Dyke. Hi, Peter.
Hello. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. And this is so exciting. Let's start with you, Peter. People have so much fascination and curiosity about virtual reality. So how is your technology at your company going to bring the outside into local hospital rooms?
Well, that's the great thing about virtual reality is it can be done in a number of ways. Basics are this. You can animate something or you can take photorealistic footage and you can put it into a 360 sphere and create an environment that kids, in this case, can actually enter. They can jump inside the experience using just simple goggles and some headsets, and they can walk around, navigate, pick up stuff, explore, learn, get educated, go see places. And it's like they're there. They're fully immersed. So it's like they left their hospital room.
Mark Middlebrook, this is super exciting for kids that will get the benefits of nature. The Timaquan Parks Foundation is making this possible. Tell us a little bit more about your involvement and which hospitalized kids are going to get the benefit of this.
Well, these are kids who are, as Peter mentioned, hospital bound and are there for very long periods of time. And Jacksonville, as you know, has a world-class healthcare system here, and we have been working on building the largest park system in the country, and we thought that there might be a synergy between the two. And what makes this project unique is the experience that they'll have is not just a computer-generated image, but it really is about our parks. And we're teaming with the national parks and the Florida Parks and the City Parks to put this on.
Will you just go into the hospital room, put the goggles on the kids, and all of a sudden they're immersed in this virtual world? Is that how it will work?
Yeah, VR Dreams is going to be on a couple of sides. We're the producers, designers of the actual software code and experiences. And as Mark said, it's going to not just be about capturing the park and putting it in a virtual reality experience. We're actually going to make it where it's gamified and actually integrated, so where we hope that the child, as they heal and can leave the hospital, they want to go to the park. They want to go to those same places that they saw. They maybe even can get some merit badges there and complete their game or their experience, if you will. But yes, the other part of VR Dreams is a service, is a charity, where we deliver the technology, the headsets, and the training and support to make sure that the kids and the staff and the parents have a wonderful experience.
And Mark Middlebrook, the health benefits of just going out and walking in the woods, or some people call it taking a forest bath, there's a wealth of scientific data to support that it's really good for you, whether you're in the hospital or not. But particularly if you're a child in the hospital, this will be really good for the children's mental and physical health, you would think.
No question. There has been a lot of literature written about how being in the woods is a good thing for both physical health and mental health. And unfortunately, a lot of these patients who are hospital-bound can't do that. So this is mm-hmm. we're going to bring the parks to them.
And you're also having a big event at the Museum of Science and History next Tuesday night. It's called Virtual Reality, Bringing Parks to Patients. What's on the agenda there?
The agenda is basically it's an introduction to the community about exactly how this program is going to work, which starts at 5:30 and runs till 7. And we hope that it's a first start to get this thing off the ground.
Now, Peter Von Dyke, if people come out to the Mosh next Tuesday night, will they get the chance to put on headsets themselves and learn a little bit about virtual reality?
Indeed. We're going to have some demo kits set up where people can try all different types of experience, including ones that would involve their hands and feet so they can actually, you know, navigate inside these environments. We're also actually going to have clinicians there who are part of VR Dreams to talk about, you know, the pain and the depression and the anxiety side that VR can really help address, especially in light of this opiate, you know, issue we have, that VR is now a increasingly more used alternative to drugs to relieve stress and pain and anxiety. And so we're actually not just going to be demonstrating this new cool experience that's fun and engaging, but also talking about the health benefits of VR and, of course, the integration with the parks.
Very nice. And when people come out Tuesday night, they'll learn a little bit more about the Tim O'Quinn Parks Foundation. You guys even have a really amazing coffee table book called Special Places. Would make a nice gift.
Yeah, very well. Yes, indeed.
So come on out to the Mosh, the Museum of Science and History, next Tuesday night, 5:30 p.m. It's called Virtual Reality, Bringing Parks to Patients. If you're curious about VR technology, you really want to come check this out. It sounds amazing. Mark Middlebrook with the Tim O'Quinn Parks Foundation. Peter Von Dyke, he's executive director of VR Dreams. Guys, thanks so much for joining us. This is really cool. Thanks for sharing it with our listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show today. Thanks so much to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board. Our theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. Also, don't forget to join us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for our new statewide call-in program, the Florida Roundup. 1A is up next. If you're listening to our rebroadcast, just keep listening for Electro Lounge. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.